Hi, everyone. I'm Anita Lustria, and in my world, conversation is king. A number of years ago, when I lost my big job of being a radio talk show host, I decided I could mope around and be sad. Okay, I did a bunch of that. Or I could move on and start a podcast so I could keep the conversation going. That's how this podcast was born. As you listen, you'll hear about things that are important to me, and hopefully you'll resonate with these topics as well. Welcome to Faith Conversations. Today on the podcast, I'm delighted to introduce to you Jennifer Barry Hawes. And if you've been paying attention at all to, your newspaper, maybe you've listened to NPR. You may have heard her already interviewed about her latest book called Grace Will Lead Us Home. And you're going to know a little bit more about her when I read the subtitle, The Charleston Church Massacre and the Hard, Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness. Pretty outstanding subtitle, and there's a lot there, as you know. But to let you know a little bit more about Jennifer before we dive into the topic and talk more about the content of her book, Jennifer writes for the Charleston-based Post and Courier, where she spent a decade covering religion and now works on a team that handles in-depth investigative reporting projects for the newspaper. Her work has won many honors, including a Pulitzer Prize, a George Polk Award, a National Headliner Award, and a DART Award for Excellence in Coverage of Trauma. And she currently lives in Charleston. Jennifer, welcome to Faith Conversations.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, this book is not for the faint of heart, and I think because it's a topic that is, because it is a situation that, of course, taps at so much of what's going on, even in our country today. The heart of it is racially motivated, racial issues, as we're talking about the murder of 9 people by Dylan Root. And I'm just wondering a couple of things right here at the outset. When, along the journey of covering this story, did you think, I'm going to write a book when this is over?
Well, to be honest, the idea for the book was not my own. So I had been covering the shooting since the night it occurred. As had a lot of journalists at our newspaper.
Mm-hmm. And where were you, by the way, when you got the news?
Sure, I was at home. It was a little after 9:15, 9:30, as I recall, when the news began to trickle out. And I had some colleagues who heard about it first, and I actually was getting ready for bed. I had my laptop out, and I was scrolling through Twitter looking at the last headlines of the day. And I started to see them come across. And at first, it was that there had been a shooting at Emmanuel. Then it became clear it was inside Emmanuel. And then it soon became clear also that there were multiple people deceased. And so at that point, I knew enough about the church's history. As you mentioned, I've been the religion writer at the paper for a while. And I knew enough about the church's history that I figured that would be important. And so that was the first story that I wrote that night, very late, about 1 o'clock in the morning, was about Emmanuel's history and how that might play an important role in this.
And let's start there, actually, for those unfamiliar with Charleston, not familiar with Emmanuel. Give us a little thumbnail sketch of that history. The church, by locals, is often referred to as Mother Emmanuel. I've read that. And you talk about that in the book. Tell us a little bit more about this historic church.
Well, Emmanuel is known as Mother Emmanuel as a term of endearment. It's the oldest AME church in the South, and therefore obviously holds an important position in that history. And the church itself has a long civil rights history. It was founded in the early 1800s, back in the days when slavery was still legal. And in fact, Charleston was the epicenter of the slave trade. So Emmanuel was born in the early 1800s and became widely known because of a man named Denmark Vesey. Vesey, in 1822, he was a member of the church who planned to launch a massive slave rebellion in the city. And it was discovered and he and about three dozen of his co-conspirators were hanged. So after that, laws really clamped down on the movement of African Americans in the city, and the church was burned to the ground. Its worshipers had to go underground until after the Civil War. So the history of the church, for a number of reasons, is extremely significant, regardless, even before this shooting. And this shooting, of course, cemented its role as a sort of premier civil rights institution in the city.
Go ahead. Sounds like you're going to say one more thing. Add one more thing.
One thing I forget that people who don't live here won't know is that Emmanuel, just for context, sits in the heart of downtown Charleston, very near Marion Square, which is a large, beautiful public park. It's right near the College of Charleston. So when you imagine the shooting occurring, this was happening in the summer when the city is filled with tourists. The church itself sits in a very busy location. So when you imagine it occurring, I think it's important to understand that context.
And even at that time in the evening, because this took place in the church at a Bible study, which had been pushed back a little bit because there'd been, a business meeting that had happened first. And so people were still out and about in the city at that point on a summer night.
Right. The church had a quarterly conference before that drew something like 60 people, and most of left. In fact, the shooter arrived when this was going on, so he waited in his car. People left the church. And by then, it was pushing 8 o'clock, so the streets around Emmanuel would have gotten quieter. But as I mentioned, it's still in the middle of the city. So most of them left, and the people who remained were 12 who stayed for Bible study, and then the pastor's wife and little 6-year-old daughter who were in his office at the time.
Where did Dylan Root live in, conjunction to where the church was? How far away was he coming from?
He lived in Columbia, South Carolina, or just right outside Columbia, which is about an hour and a half, 2 hours away from Charleston.
Okay. When you're looking into a story like this, and, when something breaks that is so catastrophic like this and has certainly the racial overtones, and we had already had some significant racial incidents in the United States at this point in time, hadn't we? What was near, close in proximity, in time proximity to this event?
Well, you're right. There were a number of police shootings, you'll remember, of unarmed African-American mm-hmm. men in particular that had generated quite a bit of controversy. And many people outside Charleston forget that just 2 months before this was the shooting death of Walter Scott, who was an unarmed Black motorist who was shot and killed by a white police officer as he was running away. And the moment was captured by a bystander on video, on his cell phone video. So Charleston was particularly on edge when this occurred, because that shooting, while it wasn't in Charleston, it was in North Charleston, which is a neighboring city. Nonetheless, it had people already paying close attention, of course, quickly concerned about potential riots when this did happen. So we were all wondering. It was a time of enormous just upheaval. The shooter was not captured that night, so the city was on edge as far as where he was. Were there more shooters? Were there more attacks planned? How were people going to react to this in the city? It was just unimaginably surreal.
How soon after the shooting was Dylan Root captured?
So Dylan Root was captured just outside Charlotte the next morning. As I recall, around 10, a little after 10 a.m.
Right. So really, relatively short amount of time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for something like this. To remind people, I think this story probably is still fresh for many people because it received so much publicity. But talk a little bit about the background of Dylan Root and how someone like this can just, not be on anyone's radar, which I think is one of the scariest things probably for most of us.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. And in that he didn't seem to have a huge number of red flags. He did confide his plans in with a friend one night when they were drinking and doing drugs. So he had mentioned it. But generally speaking, he didn't raise a lot of red flags. He himself said that he did not grow up in a racist environment, that his family wasn't racist. It appears that he developed most of his views online. He was interested in the Trayvon Martin case, which you'll remember was a story about a Black teenager who was shot and killed by a community watchman. It generated a lot of conversation about police about racial profiling. So Roof became interested in this case, and he did some online research, and it led him to do a search on the words black on white crime. And that led him then to a series of white supremacist websites. And it appears that that's really where he gained his, what he calls awakening, into what he considered to be black men in particular attacking white women, and the media was covering it up. And really, we needed to return to a day of segregation in which white people sort of reassumed their rightful place as leaders, rulers. And that's always been so interesting to me, because I wonder, what if when he searched that he had come across something else? Mm. Would this be different? You know, we will never know, of course, but right. I always wondered that. Mm.
So he hatched a plan. And the plan specifically was to go to find a predominantly black church or all black church and come in. And, you know, I don't know that the plan was any more than just come in and whoever's there, he was going to shoot. Yeah.
Well, he did. He made a plan. And in fact, he came and visited the church a number of times over the 6 months prior. So he was scouting out the church, coming to Charleston. He did have a plan.
Did he come into the church, even scouting it from the inside? That was what I didn't think. Okay.
No, he stayed outside. As far as we know, he stayed outside, although he did have a conversation with a woman at one point when she mentioned to him the Bible study on Wednesday night. And he decided to go to that instead of a Sunday service where you might have security present. So he intentionally targeted the Bible study, knowing it would be a smaller group, and in his words, would not have any white people at it. He did not want to risk that any white people would be injured in his attack. So he thought it through. While he didn't apparently have this sort of extensive planning of time and date, that seemed to be somewhat loose for him. He definitely was targeting that church, and he was targeting the Bible study.
And then when he did come and come in, he was welcomed and invited in to sit down at a table with everyone else, right?
Yeah, he walked in, and one of the women present invited him in. The pastor, Clemente Pinckney, welcomed him. In fact, Roof sat right beside Pinckney at a table. They were gathered around four round tables in a row, sort of those kind of round tables you might see at a banquet hall where maybe eight people can fit. And he sat alone with Pinckney at the first table, the one nearest the altar in the fellowship hall. The hall has a small raised altar on it, in it. And he sat right beside Reverend Pinckney, and that's the first person he shot. He sat with them for about an hour, and later told the FBI that he sort of second-guessed himself because they were very nice to him, but he decided that he, in his words, had to do it. And so when they shut their eyes for closing prayer, that's when he reached into a tactical pouch he had around his waist, which looked like a fanny pack, and pulled out a gun.
And, you know, you cover all of this at the beginning of the book because really, you have to set the stage, you have to tell about what happened, but Grace Will Lead Us Home goes on to talk about that journey that families, friends, many had to walk toward forgiveness. And I've got to say that I think that as we heard little snippets here and there in the news, and as we, you know, followed this case and eventually heard of Dylan Root sentencing, you know, maybe we heard an interview or two from a family member or someone who was connected with the case, maybe even heard those words of forgiveness, but it's not all as easy as that.
I think that a lot of people heard about the bond hearing. So the day after Roof was arrested, he had a bond hearing. And at that bond hearing, five of the victims' family members spoke, and three of them specifically said they forgave him, but they all spoke in themes of Christian love and grace, repentance, forgiveness. And so that message really captivated the country. People were so inspired by their words and their reaction, and especially coming off, as you mentioned, a number of events where cities had erupted in riots. People really appreciated their words and their gesture, but it was not indicative of all of the families. And really, most of the people that I spoke with were not able to forgive him so quickly. They had to go on a long and painful journey to get there. And I thought it was very honest of them to talk about that because, you know, as Christians, we know that that's what the Bible teaches us. But as a human being, that's difficult. And I wanted for people to understand that their journeys were really much more difficult and complicated. Even within families, people did not agree with that, And we talk about that in the book. There were in particular two sisters who disagreed. But in other families, there was agreement that they did not forgive Ruth, and they didn't have any intention of forgiving him, that what he had done was so vile, and he had not repented. He was never repentant. He said it. He wrote a few weeks after his arrest that he had not shed a tear for the innocent people he killed. So their attitude was he had not asked for forgiveness, and they were not giving it. So my point was I wanted to show that this was not a homogenous group of people. These were just like you and I. There was a wide range of views, and they all went on different journeys as a result of his actions and trying to navigate that with their faith. That to me was very interesting and very real and honest.
You know, yes, I thought so as well. And I appreciated that coming out in the book, because I think, you know, in general media, just the little snippets that you hear, you could come away with a very different conclusion. And as you said, this was the bond hearing. This whole process, that's the judicial process took how long, the entire thing?
He went to trial about 18 months after the shooting.
Okay.
So that's a long time for people to be grappling with these issues and have it hanging over their head. And I told the story of one of the women who herself is an AME minister who really grappled with forgiveness. And it wasn't until after his trial when she could release enough of her stress and anxiety about what would happen to him that she was able to really find the space to genuinely think about forgiveness and come to the point where she could feel genuinely as if she could forgive him. So 18 months went by, and it was a difficult 18 months. And it's not to say that the trial sort of magically cured all of that, but it did at least put an end to the question about what happened to Ruth.
Well, and I think that's really interesting because I think, yeah, you're kept in a defensive posture for this entire time. So how can you really deal with anything that's behind that, because you're having to stay in this singular place emotionally, which I think makes it that much harder.
And they really had it even more, it was even more difficult for them because Ruth was charged both in state court and federal court. So they had the question of what would happen with his state trial and also with his federal trial. So one didn't even necessarily solve the problem of the other. In the end, it wound up that his federal trial he received a death sentence. So in the state just allowed him to plead guilty. So he would have essentially the backup plan of remaining in prison the rest of his life should something happen with his death penalty conviction. But nonetheless, there were multiple moving factors that kept them on edge for all of that time.
One of the other things that I noticed as I read the names of all of those who were gunned down, all from different families. You know, I think that's interesting. I mean, there was more than one family member, I think maybe present from one family. How many came out? How many were not killed?
So there were 12 people in the room, And three survived, two adults and the child. And then the pastor's wife and his daughter were hiding in the secretary's office.
Okay. So I think it's also interesting that, yes, every person who was gunned down was from a different family. And you think of all of the families represented, and then the church family, and then the mushroom out from that. What I think is interesting, too, in the book, as you follow a variety of characters, of people in the story, those who survived, and when the pastor is one of those who is gunned down, and that's the person that this church looks to for spiritual support, what happened then? Because I think that's also an interesting piece of this story.
Almost the entire ministerial staff of the church was killed in that room, because not only was Reverend Pinckney killed, but Reverend Dan Simmons, who was a retired minister, who really assisted quite a bit in the day-to-day operations, because Reverend Pinckney was also a state senator and lived in another city. So he was often not at the church, and Reverend Simmons would handle many things, including the Bible study normally. And then there were several licensed ministers at one table who were also killed. So really the church had none of its ministerial staff left. So the presiding elder of the district was named the interim pastor, but he himself was new to that role and wasn't super familiar with Emmanuel. Many of the people in the congregation didn't know him, or certainly didn't know him well. So they were really starting from scratch at the same time that there was this enormous media presence in the city. Bear in mind that this occurred during the presidential election, during the primary season. So the entire national political press corps was in Charleston, because the weekend before, if I'm remembering right, Jeb Bush had an event, and the following weekend, Hillary Clinton had an event in Charleston. So everybody was here. So there was this huge media presence for months. The people at the church were dealing with not only this tremendous loss, the fact that their church had been a crime scene, but also just logistically, how do you put on Sunday service? How do you hold Bible study when there's, 100 visitors and that sort of thing? So it wasn't only the families that were thrown into sort of chaos and mourning. It was also the church itself.
Well, and how do you continue after something like that takes place in your church as well? Mm-hmm. I don't know how soon that they were able to go on with services, or if it was...
They reopened the church actually the following Sunday, and that was a point of controversy for some people. The church was released from its status as a crime scene late Saturday.
Okay.
And the church leaders were adamant they wanted to hold service as a way of showing strength and defiance in the face of what this man had done. And so they held church services that Sunday, and in fact began using the fellowship hall where the shooting occurred immediately. And that was a source of controversy, as I mentioned, but many people felt it was important to get back to normal, or to show that the church was moving forward, as a show of strength and faith and those sorts of things. So when they had that first service on Sunday, the entire street, the street outside Emmanuel is a busy four-lane thoroughfare through downtown Charleston. The street was filled with people. The church, of course, was filled with people. There were dignitaries everywhere and TV cameras and just concerned citizens. And it was quite a moment. And then we went into the 9 funerals. So the city was in that sort of state of upheaval for some time.
At one point, I know, and I'm trying to remember her name, because I've got a number of names running through my mind, but this was Tywanza's mother.
Mm-hmm. Felicia.
Felicia, thank you. Felicia Sanders. Mm-hmm. You know, she wanted to come back to Bible study at one point. She was one of the survivors of this shooting. Mm-hmm. But she didn't want to come back to that same space. And I found this interesting that the church, or that the leadership, didn't want to change those spaces. Am I correct with that remembrance?
And so Felicia was one who survived, and her son was killed right beside her, as her elderly aunt was. So if there was any family that's lost more than one person, even though they weren't immediate family members, Susie Jackson was Felicia's aunt. And so Felicia, as you can understand, did not want to return to the fellowship hall. The only restroom in the church is in the fellowship hall. So Felicia, when she went back to services, would not drink anything in the morning, so she didn't have to use the restroom. And at one point, she asked the leadership, could they please move Bible study up to the sanctuary? Because understandably, she did not want to return to the fellowship hall. She was not ready yet. And they did not do that. And that was one of a number of things that led Felicia to leave the church. She felt that the leadership did not minister to her. She was in desperate need of spiritual counseling, as you can imagine, after this happened. And she felt that she did not receive that. For one thing, she was asked a number of times if the pastor or someone else from the leadership could come to her home and speak with her, because she was very traumatized about going back to the church building, and that did not happen. So Felicia wound up, interestingly, going to a church almost right next door to Emmanuel, which is an historically white church. And remember, I told you the man, Denmark Vesey, who tried to start the slave rebellion? Well, Denmark Vesey began his spiritual life at Second Presbyterian, the white church Felicia now attends. So it's an interesting little closing of one historical loop in Charleston, where people still remain oftentimes in their own segregated silos, particularly when it comes to church time. So it's fascinating.
Any other what were some of the other difficulties with the church? I in my reading, I remember reading about, cards and letters and all kinds of correspondence and people sending gifts and whatnot to church members and survivors, and some of those things not making their way into the hands of the people they were sent for.
So people from all over the country and the world really sent condolence letters and gifts to the church because they didn't know how to reach the survivors or the victims' family members. And some of the letters would just say to Emmanuel AME Church, and some would say things like, in care of Jennifer Pinckney, in care of Felicia Sanders. And so the church would send that mail to them in bags because there was so much of it. And the families all told me that they received mail that had been opened, some of it that was marked empty. These are letters that had their names on them. So it wasn't as if it was confusing as to who the mail was for or was intended for. And that, as you can imagine, generated considerable concern and frustration from the victims' families and the survivors. That was just one example of when people sent money to the church, the families and the survivors felt that their intentions were that that money would go to help them, because many of them were not able to work right away. They were paying all kinds of bills that are involved with settling an estate. And so when the church divided up the money, it took the position that if people sent it to the church, they intended it for the church. And the church kept slightly more than half of it and then gave slightly less than half to the nine families and the survivors. So that was a source of controversy. And then another piece of that is that the church, as best as I can gauge, and they've never publicly accounted for how they divided the money specifically, but it appears, based on my conversations with the families and survivors, that they divided I believe it was about 1.7 million between nine families of people who lost a loved one. They each got about 150,000, and then Polly Shepherd, the survivor who did not lose a loved one, also received that amount, which would add up to roughly the right amount of money. So Felicia Sanders, the woman you mentioned, she not only lost her son, but she also was a survivor, as was her granddaughter, the 11-year-old girl in the room who she was raising. But she did not receive any additional money for that little girl. Now, Felicia's always said, it doesn't matter about me. I worked my whole life and made a good living, but the little girl would need therapy, and perhaps intensive therapy for the rest of her life. She was in that room
right.
and then was walking around afterward right. as the police cleared the space. So you can imagine the trauma to this child. So Felicia, one of her great hurts and remaining great hurts to this day is that the church did not provide any of that money for her granddaughter.
Any others leave the church over this besides Felicia?
Well, Polly Shepherd, the other survivor, also left. She attends a different AME church in the city, which is Emmanuel's daughter church. Okay. So those are the two adult survivors in the room. Jennifer Pinckney does not live in Charleston, so she was never super involved with the church in that way. Mm-hmm. She was obviously is her part of her husband's ministry, but number of the family members, Nadine Collier, who's the first person to speak the words of forgiveness, does not go to Emmanuel anymore. Mm. There are a number of people like that. There are some family members who remain there, but there's really not that many.
Well, and I think it's what's interesting is, you know, we know the story, we know basically what happened, but it's the inner workings and what happens over time in the lives of people and those who come around them or those that interact with them, or in this case, the house of worship where this took place, and what was once a spiritual home for them, that becomes really, in essence, kind of a re-traumatization to them, you know, and so it becomes even a bigger journey of forgiveness because all of a sudden it's no longer just Dylan Roof, which that's big enough. But then when you have people that you think should be caring for you spiritually and a place where that has been a spiritual home for you, you know, speak to that issue because this really was a re-traumatization for a number of people.
Right. And I remember standing with Felicia outside Emmanuel one day and she was crying and saying, I've lost my son and now I'm losing my church. She had attended Emmanuel her whole life and had multiple generations of her family. So yes, I think that was a re-traumatization, or it was an additional traumatization for her to have to leave her church and go elsewhere to find that spiritual nourishment. And I want to emphasize this is not regarding the members of Emmanuel, but the leadership of the church
right.
at the time. So Felicia had to leave, Polly left. I think that there are a lot of lessons to be learned for pastors and church members everywhere who, of course, we hope never deal with something of this magnitude, but even on a more day-to-day basis to understand and be thinking about who is the most important person in that moment. What is the most important thing for me to do and to attend today? I think that those are lessons that we can all take to heart as we deal with people in our churches who are hurting and not even due to something of this magnitude, but who have lost a loved one, yeah. who are dealing with a trauma, who are dealing with a sudden upheaval. And that's part of why I wanted to get into this, was to help people on a more day-to-day basis know how they can assist people, but also, you know, of course, God forbid this happens again, but the reality is it is happening. We had the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh.
That's right.
We had a shooting at a synagogue in California, just a month or two ago now. So it is happening. And I think there are also very big lessons to be learned for communities that deal with mass shootings in the future as well.
It is the same church leadership at Emmanuel currently that was during this time period that we're talking about?
Mm-hmm. The interim pastor at the time is still the presiding elder of that district. Mm-hmm. The pastor of the church is different. But he remains in a leadership role.
And I think, you know, I just wanted to add to your comment about the fact that Felicia had attended there her whole life. And at this time when, you know, of all times to have to go and find a new place to receive spiritual sustenance, but I'll add to that, to also develop and find a whole new community of people to come around her. I mean, maybe she knew some people there, but I mean, that's something that takes time and the opening up of your heart and soul at a time when you don't really have much margin for doing that. So it's like even bigger than just losing that place of worship where you were maybe sustained spiritually, that broader community is a huge piece as well.
Sure. And the memories that you acquire in a church of where your children are baptized and where you took communion or where you prayed over a loss, those memories are all tied up in the church that you attend, especially as you mentioned, when you've gone your whole life. And, you know, Felicia, interestingly, because church is still such a segregated time of the week, she grew up just blocks away from Emmanuel and Second Presbyterian, but she had never been inside Second Presbyterian before. So not only did she not know many people, in fact, it was a whole strange new place for her. But when she originally went there because she was looking for overflow space for her son's funeral. They held a joint funeral for her son and their aunt. And she went there and met with the pastor, Cress Darwin, and she described for me, I wasn't there at this moment, she described it for me, of how she walked into the sanctuary, and she said it just felt right. It just felt right. She just felt the Spirit telling her it was right. And I think that gave her a great deal of comfort where this was a very new place. So she at least had that to go on. And when she returned, and began talking with Reverend Darwin, she told me how in some ways it was helpful that she wasn't in the AME church, because she had grown up in the church and had grown up with a reverence for the pastors there. And it's a hierarchical church.
Right.
So the pastors are held, you know, as sort of in an elevated role, where in a Presbyterian church, you feel more of a sense of power sort of flowing from the people upward. Yeah. So when she went there and spoke with Reverend Darwin, she described how she could just let loose. Yeah. She didn't worry about the formalities or the sort of those small things of respect that you want to be aware of. And so in some ways she said it was actually helpful because she was so raw and so just she wasn't in full control of her emotions all the time. And so, in fact, I think was helpful in some strange way that this wasn't the hierarchy she was accustomed to. And then moving forward, I think having new people around her at times presented some challenges. She told me a story once about how she went to help at a big volunteer outreach thing that the Presbyterian churches here do. And somebody asked her or directed her toward the line of people needing things instead of the line for the volunteers. And it was that sort of thing where she's had to overcome and deal with some of the sort of ingrained, that ingrained messiness that we're all dealing with when it comes to race.
I want to know what a story like this does to the one covering it, to you. And as you get close to the people that you're interviewing and walking alongside, getting the story as you're covering it, but then also as you go back and then, you know, get what you need to write a book like this, what does a story like this do to you, the journalist?
Well, I have written a lot about tragedy. And so while I've never covered a tragedy of this scope, for sure, at least I had some coping mechanisms in place. And my husband is an ICU nurse, interestingly. So he deals with a lot of death in his work. So we talk about this kind of thing a lot. We're pretty open about how it affects us. And, you know, I've just learned to try to look at these stories, and particularly this one, from a place of feeling honored that people will allow me to walk this journey with them, that they'll trust me with this story. You know, I'm a stranger to them when they meet me, and it's a lot to ask of somebody to place their trust in someone they don't know. And that helps me to think of it as being honored to travel this journey with them. But it also, you know, it makes you more aware of your security. It makes me hold my family closer and be extra thankful when I come home and they're here and I'm here. And sometimes it just means taking some time for myself. I'm a big nature buff, and so I'll often go off by myself and just take some time if I need it, just to have some space to sort of let it go.
Yeah.
But I really try hard not to bring that to the people that I'm talking to, because I don't want for them to feel like they have to comfort me. Mm. Their loss is so great, and I don't want that to be on them.
One of the things I read about, and I want to ask, have you respond to this in two ways, because I want you to tell what this was like for you as well. When everything was said and done, you know, and the book at some point toward the end, you know, has, you talk about various people, survivors and family members, you know, leaving this, the sentence comes down and this ordeal is all over, you know, the trials, plural, are all done. There has to be a tremendous letdown. There's no longer that sense of camaraderie, coming together each day to be in or near the courtroom, or, you know, and all of this. I mean, this is something that happens over the long haul. When something like this ends, there has to be not just a letdown for the people involved, but I'm thinking for those covering it as well, the reporters involved. Maybe talk about both.
Yeah, and you know, there was quite a lot of media who covered this trial. And so we had a courtroom. You can't bring cameras and things like that into a federal courthouse. Right. So they had set up a separate courtroom where the media could hang out, people could tweet and all that sort of thing. And I was most of the time in the regular courtroom, so I wasn't with them. But it was really neat when we had breaks and we're waiting for rulings from the judge and that sort of thing, just to meet your sort of comrades in a way from all around the country, who some of whom you only know as bylines. And it was, and some of us still keep in touch. There's a reporter from the AP here, Meg Kennard. She and I have kept in touch quite a bit since then, and others. So it is a letdown, but in a way too, we were all so exhausted. It was these long, long, emotionally grueling days. And for those of us at the Post and Courier, even though the trial ended, the coverage didn't, because one thing to keep in mind is that the judge had sealed quite a bit of information to until afterwards. So he would unseal information as we went forward after that. So then we'd be writing about it again, or there would be some other thing that came up. And I was writing the book, so I was still in touch with the family members and all that. I was trying to communicate with as often as possible for the sake of knowing what was going on in their lives. So in a way, it was a letdown, yes, in terms of not seeing all those people all the time. But I have to say, for me, by the end of it, I was emotionally just exhausted, and welcomed the break. And it was funny, the last day of it, I went to a restaurant with some other reporters from the New York Times, who we had sat at a table with a lot. And then I realized it was Bible study night. I had lost track of what day it was, but it was a Wednesday. And so all of a sudden I just excused myself, and I actually went to the church, because I thought, A, it would be interesting, and B, it might be the ending of the book. You start at Bible study and you end at Bible study. It wound up not being the ending, but it's just an example of how it continues on. The story, we're still covering it today. It was just the fourth anniversary, and so we're still writing about it, even all this time after the trial ended.
Yeah, when you don't live in a locale, you forget that it, the story goes on. People continue on with their lives.
Yeah, their lives continue.
Yeah. What is your biggest hope? Well, one of the things I want to say, you know, you, after your epilogue in the book, also included in the back of the book are the remarks by President, then President Obama, in eulogy for Reverend Clementa Pinckney. And you know, that I think many of us witnessed that, or have, and I've watched it multiple times since. And that's that, not only the eulogy, but many of us remember, of course, then President Obama singing Amazing Grace. And I mean, it was just a powerful, powerful moment. And that is included in the back of the book as well, which I think is really powerful to have that. Do you like that that's included? Do you appreciate that?
No, I really do. And it wasn't my idea to do that. But I'm really glad that the editor at St. Martin's Press came up with that idea because that speech encapsulated so much for the family members. And I can't imagine having a president other than Obama at the time, because for them, it was so meaningful to have him come to Charleston and to hear those words from him. And it really felt very much like a church service when he delivered those remarks. Yeah. And obviously when he sang Amazing Grace, yeah. People just went wild over that. It was amazing. And in fact, that's the title of the book. It comes ultimately from the hymn Amazing Grace, yeah. but he references that line repeatedly. And I really like that. I like how it spoke to a journey to forgiveness and not an immediacy, because I think that's where we all are in our lives. We're on a journey and we are not yet at the destination. So his remarks, it was interesting. One of the victims, Myra Thompson, she has a very large family. And I was standing outside the church once with one of her brothers, a young man in his early 30s. And he told me that that eulogy was for his generation, a lot like the I Have a Dream speech by Martin Luther King for an older generation, because it spoke hope in a moment of grief and hopelessness. And I thought that was really interesting. That was one of the reasons I was glad that they decided to include the full text of his remarks.
Yeah, me too. I thank you. That's helpful to hear, and to hear that story. That's powerful too, to hear from a young, you know, a 30-year-old, the meaning of that today. I want to know from you, what is your hope for the book? You know, every book has its life and comes into the hands of people that want to and need to read it. What do you hope people take away from the reading of Grace Will Lead Us Home?
Well, on a practical level, let me say the proceeds from this book will go to fund summer internships at our newspaper for journalism students of color. And my hope is that will help us diversify our staff and other staffs around the country as they hire these graduates. It's so important for us to do a better job of reflecting the communities that we cover.
I love that.
So practically speaking, that's my hope. On a more sort of esoteric level, I hope that people come away with this understanding that their own struggles with forgiveness are okay, that we all deal with these questions differently, even if we're attempting to be on the same path. And I also hope that people see the folks involved with this as more than a homogenous group of people who sort of instantly forgave Dylann Roof and then moved on, and there's this happy, crisp bow at the end of the story, because that's not the reality. The reality is they're very interesting people, they're very different people, and their journeys are, to me, fascinating and important lessons for us to, there are important lessons for us to learn about how we handle adversity in our lives and how we handle traumas in our lives. And I hope people walk away understanding that they're all interesting people in their own right, and not only as a homogenous group.
I think the book is tremendous. There's a lot going on, and the fact that you do follow individuals through this journey, I think, is one of the powerful parts of the book, as well as telling the story so well. Jennifer, thank you so much for sharing, being with us on Faith Conversations. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Again, Grace Will Lead Us Home, The Charleston Church Massacre and the Hard, Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness, written by Jennifer Barry Hawes, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. And to everyone else listening, I say keep the conversation going.